Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Greetings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, the Alpine Avalanche, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org. Hello, this is Michael reading the Big Bend Sentinel for the week of May 24th, 2020. These articles were published on Wednesday, May 27th, 2020. Presidio County reports second highest unemployment rate in the state, by Abby Perot. Presidio County recorded a 20.7 unemployment rate for April 2020, the second highest rate in the state of Texas, according to the Texas Labor Market Information's Local Area Unemployment Statistics Report for April 2020. Presidio had previously had the fifth highest unemployment rate in March at 10.9%, showing the drastic drop in employment between March and April, locally. Presidio has long lagged behind other counties and was ninth highest unemployed county a year ago at 5.1% in April 2019. In Texas, Starr County in the Rio Grande is the only one of Texas's 254 counties with a higher unemployment rate for April 2020, clocking in at 24.3%. Presidio isn't alone. Texas's 12.8% unemployment rate is the state's worst on record. However, Presidio's latest numbers show that the county is being disproportionately affected by job losses. While the county has a civilian labor force of 3,025 people, a total of 627 of those residents have claimed unemployment during April alone, meaning one in five members of the workforce are hurting. A recent report from the Workforce Solutions Borderplex stated, total unemployment claimants for the Borderplex region in April 2020, 329 through 52, was 39,393. This reflects an increase of more than 24,000 claimants from the previous month. The Borderplex covers counties across Far West Texas. The WSB reported the worst-hit industries were leisure and hospitality, trade, transportation, and utilities, and professional and business services. The month of March was impacted with coronavirus closures in its last week, but April bore the brunt of the pandemic's impact. As coronavirus-related closures hit this spring, West Texas crude prices plummeted almost in lockstep due to an international flood of product into the market. In turn, Permian Basin oil field jobs and many jobs that support the industry's operations were lost. Presidio, Hudspeth counties announced first cases, and Ojinaga case count climbs, by Stephen Paulson. As coronavirus numbers climbed across the United States and across the world, Far West Texas remained a happy outlier, with almost no cases in the region. But that sense of relative safety started to falter last month, after Ojinaga and Brewster County both confirmed their first known cases of coronavirus, and it may be gone for good after this week, as both Presidio and Hudspeth counties announced their first confirmed cases, and the number of cases that are known in Ojinaga climbed to 11. On Saturday, Presidio County Judge Cinderella Guevara confirmed the first coronavirus case in her county. The patient is a woman in her 40s, and the case is believed to be travel-related, according to the news release. The woman was tested at a PCHS clinic, not at a mobile testing site, and the state was conducting contact tracing to determine if anyone had been in contact with her, the release stated. The same day, Hudspeth County residents received even more worrying news. A female resident in her 20s had been confirmed to have the virus, and the case was community-related, meaning the patient had likely contracted the disease locally rather than through travel. Although both news releases came on letterhead from the Department of State Health Services, the same agency that runs the coronavirus tracker, the cases saw a days-long wait to be added to the state system. Presidio County's case wasn't added to the state database until Monday, and the Hudspeth County case took even longer, with officials adding it on Tuesday. The cases come as the number of cases in the region continue to grow. On April 30th, Brewster County announced their first case in the region. That patient, a person in their 60s in South Brewster County, is now considered recovered, local health officials have said. Meanwhile, the case count in Ojinaga is also rising. The first case was announced in April, but the number last week climbed to 9, according to officials in the city. In a recording last week from BM Radio Ojinaga, Ojinaga Mayor Martin Sanchez Valles confirmed the news. He warned listeners that the count in Chihuahua State in Mexico was rising and asked residents to stay vigilant about social distancing guidelines. Then on Wednesday, the radio station said on social media that there were 11 cases in Ojinaga, for a total of 4 women and 7 men. It cited Mayor Valles. Valles did not respond to a request for comment by press time. Pandemic snags advocates' petition to make Jeff Davis a wet county, by Abby Perot. Another attempt to unify Jeff Davis County's liquor laws and turn all 4 precincts wet may be doomed, this time due to a lack of signatures collected during the pandemic. The Fort Davis Chamber of Commerce said they were unable to collect signatures required to get on the November ballot because of coronavirus. But the group is holding out hope that the state will acknowledge the challenge of collecting signatures during a pandemic and relax its rules. In normal times, groups must collect 35% of the total voters from the last gubernatorial election, coming out to 408 signatures this year. There's a 60-day window between the application being filed and the signatures being due. According to Melissa Henderson, executive director for the Fort Davis Chamber of Commerce, "In reality, I actually had about 12 days. We hustled as long as we could." The group was able to collect somewhere around 350 signatures of registered Jeff Davis County voters, but their efforts were severely hampered when the county, like many in the area, declared a disaster and went into a stay-at-home order. The threat of viral spread meant door-to-door petitioning could be dangerous, leaving the chamber with few options to collect the rest of the signatures. This is not the first time the chamber has fought to open up Jeff Davis County to more liquor sales. The same changes were unsuccessfully petitioned for in 2016 and 2015. The county's precincts have long had disparate rules about selling and serving alcohol. In Precinct 1, the only way to sell alcohol is if you're a restaurant where alcohol can be consumed on site, but cannot make up more than 49% of the restaurant sales. The local dollar store, whose chain often sells beer and wine in its shops, is prohibited from selling because it falls in Precinct 1. Nearby businesses in Precinct 2 are partial wet, so they can sell alcohol, but not for on-site consumption. The precinct line between 1 and 2 is at the south wall of Stone Village Market. Everything north of Stone Village can only do consumer-to-consumer sales, not on-site sales. Everything south of the market on State Street has to be a restaurant. Meanwhile, Precinct 3 is completely dry, while Precinct 4, home to Valentine, is completely wet. The petition was turned over to the county clerk, and Henderson is expecting a rejection. "Once I get that letter saying I didn't have enough signatures, then we'll be looking at alternatives to file based on what's happening with other cities doing similar things," Henderson said. The coronavirus has created all kinds of new lawsuits. Henderson pointed to recent lawsuits in other states around the country that are pressing government officials to relax rules for ballot measures due to the interference of coronavirus. Some states have chosen to allow digital signatures, while others have stopped requiring the signature collector to witness every signature. Last week, a U.S. district judge ordered Ohio to accept electronic signatures for petitions and to extend the signature deadline an additional 30 days. Henderson is hopeful that Texas will make an exception, and the Chamber of Commerce plans to seek legal help to advocate for their cause. Alpine families up in arms after hospital clinic cuts off pediatric care. By Stephen Paulson. Controversy is brewing in Alpine after a pediatrician at Big Bend Regional Medical Center sent out letters abruptly severing doctor-patient relationships with multiple children. While the hospital has not publicly addressed the move, the affected families believe it was in retaliation for their opposition to coronavirus emergency measures. The pediatrician in question, Ecta Escobar, is a member of the local COVID-19 task force and the local health authority for Brewster County. She's become a prominent face of emergency measures in the Tri-County, fielding questions from reporters and concerned residents about the pandemic and what local officials are doing to handle it. Rick Flores, CEO for BBRMC, did not respond to a request for comment. Escobar declined to comment, instead referring the Big Bend Sentinel to a hospital spokesperson. A spokesperson for the hospital also declined to comment on the situation, citing pending litigation. But in a statement, she stressed that Big Bend Regional Medical Center remains committed to improving the health of all people in our community in a caring, quality-focused manner. The fallout started earlier this month when Adam Brandt, manager of the Bargain Barn in Alpine, received a letter from the hospital's clinic, the Big Bend Regional Health Center. It said he was no longer aligned with Escobar's recommendations for his children's care and that a successful patient-physician relationship does not seem possible at this time. It asked him to call the hospital so that we may transfer your records to your new doctor. It was a shock, said Brandt, who used the hospital for medical care for his three children, aged 4, 6, and 8. We've never had any issues with care for our children. This really came out of left field. He wondered if his opposition to coronavirus emergency measures, including viewpoints he expressed at an Alpine City Council meeting against a proposed mask ordinance, had caused the termination. A few days later, another Alpine parent, Lynette Barboza, received a letter with the same wording. She had also used the clinic for pediatric care for her two children, including her three-year-old with cerebral palsy. While Barboza says she hasn't spoken about coronavirus health measures publicly, her mother, Monica Quiroga, has. Barboza also works at Old Gringo Cafe, her family's bar and grill, that has reopened with limited capacity in compliance with state reopening rules. Like Brandt, Barboza was surprised and frustrated by the letter. I've got enough to worry about, she said in an interview last week. I'm a single mother, I've got two kids, and one of my kids has disabilities. Her kids had adored seeing Dr. Escobar, she said. But with no other pediatricians at the clinic, she worried she'd have to start making long-haul commutes to get them care. Due to her son's cerebral palsy, Barboza already travels to Fort Worth for specialty care. But having to travel for regular checkups felt like a logistical nightmare for a number of reasons. We've got to get used to a whole new set of medical professionals, Barboza said. That's a bit of a challenge with the sensory overload for her son with cerebral palsy. It remains to be seen how the situation will play out or whether BBRMC will present an alternative explanation for the termination. But the controversy bubbled to the surface earlier this month after Barboza's mother, Monica Quiroga, posted a lengthy statement on Facebook. I've been a vocal proponent of local business in Alpine, Texas, being open, Quiroga wrote. Escobar didn't like those views, Quiroga wrote, so is refusing to treat my grandchildren from now on. She accused Escobar of publicly funded bullying and says she's legitimately concerned that the boys will not receive adequate care in an emergency. Escobar is uncompensated for her public work as the Brewster County Health Authority and as a member of the local COVID-19 task force. Neither of the boys have been to ECTA since well before the coronavirus shutdowns, so she hasn't advised my daughter in any manner relating to the virus, Quiroga added. Therefore, it is impossible for Lynette Barboza to not be aligned with her. She shared several photos and videos with the Post, including photos of her grandchildren and the letter from the hospital. A day after receiving the letter, Barboza spoke on the phone with BBRMC CEO Rick Flores. In a recording of the phone call, which was also shared in the social media post, Flores says he's gotten a lot of intel about the letter, but is kind of at a loss about the situation and is not a happy camper. He said he had heard from the clinic about concerns with doctor-patient relationships and that the next thing I know, we're getting hammered about letters we sent out. And he says he was aware of the budding controversy on social media. It's not my business or the hospital's business when you open, he said to Barboza in the phone call. That's between you and the county. In a follow-up call the next day, Flores said he wanted to meet with Barboza and Escobar to resolve some simple communication challenges. And while he did not directly acknowledge why the clinic had terminated pediatric care for Barboza's children, he referenced statements on social media and said that Escobar may have perceived those as questioning her ability to provide care. Barboza, though, stressed that she hadn't made any critical comments of Escobar. I'm just a little confused, Barboza said. Me too, Flores agreed. In the end, though, no such meeting happened. When Barboza said she wanted to bring a supportive party to the meeting, Flores apparently thought she meant a lawyer. Wow, he said, I'm not going to allow an attorney in. Barboza quickly stressed that didn't mean an attorney and that that wasn't where I was going at all. But in a follow-up interview with the Big Bend Sentinel, Barboza said the statement felt like an escalation and made her second guess whether she should meet with Flores and Escobar. Instead, Barboza did ultimately retain a lawyer. In a letter to Flores last week, she accused Escobar of acting in an unprofessional and discriminatory manner towards her children and said the hospital will likely hear from our counsel in the coming days. She also said she might file complaints with the Texas Medical Board and the American Medical Association. The letter makes three demands: a formal apology letter from Escobar and the hospital, a reprimand and or removal of Escobar from any administrative positions at the hospital, and assurances to Barboza and any other affected families and their children will not have their care affected by personal vendettas. Barboza added that she intends to settle this matter amicably, but stressed that Flores had given her a new perspective on the situation by bringing up lawyers. You expressed hesitance to meet with me and a witness and gave me pause when you brought up the idea of having attorneys present, she wrote in the letter. As I thought about your words, I realized that you are probably right. I do likely need an attorney to represent my children's interest and ensure that they receive appropriate medical care when seeking treatment in our rural hospital and clinic. Barboza's lawyer, Art Martinez de Vara, said in an interview Tuesday that he had filed a complaint with the Texas Medical Board and was also considering filing a lawsuit over what he described as a blatant violation of the civil rights of Barboza's children. They're a governmental entity as a public health district, he said. They have to treat everyone equally. They can't discriminate. He called it very bad practice to deny a child health care because of the parents' political stance. In interviews with the Big Bend Sentinel, neither Barboza nor Brandt seemed happy about the escalating situation, but both said they were just worried about the safety and well-being of their children. My concern is, should we have a medical emergency and I take him to the hospital, will I still get the same treatment for him as I would under normal circumstances? Barboza asked. And with a child with cerebral palsy, medical emergencies are not a matter of if, but when, she said. Brandt felt similarly. He said he didn't begrudge Escobar's viewpoints and might have viewed the situation differently if she was in private practice. But with Escobar serving in a public leadership position during the coronavirus crisis, he said the situation was a violation of the public's trust. Asked if he thought that trust could be rebuilt, Brandt didn't think so. It's too little too late, he said. She's burned bridges. How can you put them back together? Undocumented immigrants in West Texas face high temps and little chance at asylum, by Abby Perot. For a fit individual, it's a 10-day hike through the desert, and that's with supplies, said public affairs officer for Big Bend Sector Greg Davis, speaking out about the journey undocumented immigrants attempt when trying to enter the United States without detection. Along with the rough terrain, temperatures near the border routinely surpass 100 degrees. Supplies and water are scarce, and those hoping to avoid border patrol are up against a complex, well-funded surveillance apparatus. Immigrants at the U.S.-Mexico border often hire coyotes, individuals who promise to secure immigrants safe passage into the United States for a price. Those coyotes tell them it's a short walk, that once you cross the border, you're in dreamland, Davis said. In reality, the final leg of the journey has cost many undocumented immigrants their lives. Especially in the summer months, there is a tipping point where the goal to obfuscate capture is turned on its head. On three consecutive days last week, Border Patrol was dispatched to rescue immigrants who were turning themselves in. Surrendering their goal of entering the U.S. undetected, the immigrants had climbed high peaks to get cell service, then dialed 911. They might get a cell signal. They might connect. They're only speaking Spanish, and they get a 911 operator that patches it through to Border Patrol, Davis said. It becomes a real task to find out where they are. The Big Bend Border Patrol sector dispatched helicopters and agents on horseback to traverse the hazardous terrain last week, searching for undocumented individuals based on the provided vague descriptions of their locations. The agency said agents in Alpine, Presidio, and Sierra Blanca were dispatched last week, responding and rendering aid to multiple individuals with life-threatening heat-related illnesses. The agency also retrieved the body of a deceased individual who had succumbed to the extreme weather during travel. The self-surrender itself indicates dire circumstances. Davis said he even had three individuals turn themselves over to him after they spotted his vehicle. He remarked, "I'm a public affairs officer, not a Border Patrol agent, but they turned themselves in to me." In these situations, we have a law enforcement role, but for these situations, our first priority and only priority at that point is life-saving medical attention. We'll deal with the other stuff later, said Davis. The other stuff is, of course, enforcement of immigration law. After rescue and treatment by medical personnel, the individuals were processed according to applicable immigration laws, a Border Patrol press release stated. Davis said that after being treated for any health issues, almost all apprehended immigrants are now deported right across the border within a period of hours, due to new procedures under coronavirus. Those who are put into detention in the U.S. are mostly individuals with active warrants, Davis said. Recently, the government in Mexico has begun accepting flights into Mexico City, where Customs and Border Protection will deport repeat offenders who have repeatedly attempted entry into the United States. I think the intent is a lot of people from third countries will realize they've given it a try, and now it might be better to go back to Honduras or Guatemala, especially with the temperatures and COVID-19 stuff, Davis said of the new flights that move immigrants away from the border. Peter Shea, a Los Angeles-based lawyer and a founder of the Center for Human Rights and Constitutional Law, said the removal of adults to countries where they may face persecution appears to violate both federal law, granting all immigrants the right to seek asylum, and the United Nations Protocol, relating to the status of refugees, to which the United States is a party. Summary and mass deportations without assessing the health of the migrants if they are infected with COVID-19 unquestionably increases the danger of the spread of COVID-19 throughout Mexico, Central, and South America, Shea added. Both from a legal and health perspective, the current mass deportation policy is cruel and irrational. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issued an order on May 20th that indefinitely allows immigration authorities to rapidly deport asylum seekers to Mexico or their home countries. CBP has also extended its closure of the Trusted Traveler program until at least July 6th, citing fears of exposure to coronavirus. Additionally, the U.S. has extended the border's closure to all non-essential travel until June 22nd. Shea concluded, "It wouldn't surprise us in the least if the administration attempts to keep these border policies in place long after the COVID-19 pandemic is brought under control." In the meantime, while crossings have declined in the Big Bend when compared to last year, many are still risking their lives in hopes of remaining in the United States. Asked why he thought undocumented individuals continued to come to the Big Bend, Davis said, "Desperate people will do desperate things, and oftentimes that puts their lives in jeopardy."
The Big Bend Sentinel News. Porters sees half of price gouging complaints in Tri-County. As economic fallout builds from the coronavirus crisis, so has the number of price gouging complaints filed in the Tri-County area. By Stephen Paulson, May 20th, 2020. Tri-County. As economic fallout builds from the coronavirus crisis, so has the number of price gouging complaints filed in the Tri-County area. Since the end of March, there have been at least 6 price gouging complaints in the Tri-County area. 3 of them targeted Porter's stores in Alpine, Fort Davis, and Presidio. A Stripe store in Alpine also saw a complaint, with one consumer alleging they were charging way more than average for gas. But smaller businesses saw complaints too, including a gas station in Alpine and a general store in Terlingua. The Big Bend Sentinel first started reporting on local price gouging complaints in March, after Marfa City Council discussed increasing prices at the local Porters. Councilmember Irma Salgado noted that egg prices had doubled from $4 to $8, while Councilmember Raw Laura also raised concerns about store pricing. Porters acknowledged they had raised prices on some items, citing higher prices from suppliers, but they said they were not gouging. "That's not who we are," Kai Ellison, a spokesperson for Porters, told the Big Bend Sentinel in March. "There's never been a situation where we think we can take advantage of customers." At the time, the only local price gouging complaint concerns Porters, a non-existing grocery store in Alpine that was allegedly charging too much for meat. The Texas Attorney General Office so far has been unable to provide more information on the complaint, which the agency received by phone. This latest batch of records, which the Big Bend Sentinel received last week, provided a more complete picture of complaints in the area. Still, an AG spokesperson stressed the records are simply complaints received and processed by our office and do not reflect legal determinations of a scam or price gouging. The local records come as complaints of price gouging balloon in Texas and across the country. At press time, there were more than 8,600 price gouging complaints in Texas, up from around 3,000 in late March. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton has accused major egg producers of possible price gouging, and Texas Agriculture Commissioner Sid Miller, along with several state AGs, has accused four cattle packing houses of possible price fixing. The USDA is also investigating the price fixing allegations. Meanwhile, price gouging lawsuits in both Texas and California are targeting grocery stores and/or egg producers. The group suing, which also includes Texas AG Paxton, argues there was an illegal scheme to jack up egg prices. Texas law says businesses can't raise prices to exorbitant or excessive levels during a pandemic. But unlike other states, including California, Texas has no specific price limits. That lack of clarity has been criticized by some legal analysts. In a blog post from last year, Dallas law firm Gray, Reed, and McGraw complained that Texas law left merchants vulnerable by offering no guidance on what makes a price excessive. Ultimately, a lawyer wrote, the question of whether a price was exorbitant or excessive will likely be answered by the jury on a case-by-case basis. In the Tri-County area, price gouging complaints hit businesses in Fort Davis, Terlingua, and Presidio, along with three in Alpine. Three of those complaints targeted porters. A man in March told the AG's office that he was concerned about the chain raising prices on eggs at its Fort Davis store, but he stressed that he heard about the increases from his mother and he cannot make a firsthand allegation. Later in April, a woman contacted the AG's office to complain about higher prices at Porter's Alpine. She cited price increases on a number of items, including eggs and oatmeal, but did not provide more details. By far, the most detailed report against Porter's concerned a store in Presidio. In that case, a man near Lajitas said he went to the store to pick up four cases of water, but there was no price posted. Some cashiers were kind enough to point out to me that the water was $13.99 a case. That man, James Warren, told the AG's office. He called the situation outrageous, but said he had to have water and had no choice but to pay the prices. Later, Warren said he realized the water was just listed as grocery on his receipt rather than specifically itemized like they do everything else. In his complaint, he included photos of his receipts, which showed he paid around $56 for buying four of an item called grocery, each of which was priced at $13.99. In an email response to the Big Bend Sentinel, Kai Ellison said he understood challenges we are all facing due to the coronavirus pandemic, but wanted to reiterate our commitment to our customers. Ellison declined to comment on the egg probes and lawsuits targeting other stores as well as at least one of Porter's suppliers, Calmaine, which produces Sunup eggs. We trust our justice system to do the right thing, he said. But he did specifically address the water complaint, citing conversations with the regional store director. He said Porter's and Presidio had never sold water at $13.99 per case. The closest prices for water were a 12-pack of Ozarka for $12.99 and 18-pack of Ozarka for $17.99. Both were 1.5-liter packs, which Porter sold basically at cost, he said. In an interview with the Big Bend Sentinel, Warren stood by his story. They were trying to hide it, he said, of the, quote, grocery charge on his receipt. That's what caught my eye. He pointed to an image included in his complaint, which shows a case of water with a $13.99 price tag written out on it in pen. In a follow-up inquiry about the image, Ellison said the pictured water was intended to be sold for $1.99 each and that the company paid $33.84 for the packs. He included an invoice for Dasani water. I'm not sure why we even sold those at $13.99, he said. Extrapolating from the $1.99 price, he said the case should have sold for around $47.75. It wasn't just Porter's, though. A consumer also complained that a Stripes in Alpine was charging way more than average for gasoline. The store was selling gasoline for $2.35 a gallon, the consumer complained, while data from the American Automobile Association showed that the state average is closer to $1.57. Stripes' parent company, Cal's Convenience, Inc., did not respond to a request for comment. Two smaller businesses also received complaints. A consumer alleged the Triangle was charging too much for gas and said she believed all of the local gas stations worked together to keep prices high. Eric Faust, owner at the Triangle, acknowledged that his gas prices might be higher than elsewhere in the state, citing costs associated with transporting gasoline to the remote Tri-County region. But he stressed that we're the cheapest ones in town, and he said never discuss gas prices with management at other local gas stations. There's no price gouging going on, he said. I can promise you. Meanwhile, Interlingua, Cottonwood General Store, also saw a complaint after a consumer said the store was unpacking toilet paper and selling individual rolls for around $1.80. Rick Page, the owner of that store, acknowledged the store was selling individual rolls. Cottonwood has struggled to get a reliable supply of toilet paper and also tried selling large commercial rolls, he said. The store sold individual rolls to make sure everyone could get toilet paper rather than just the first three or four people. Still, Page stressed that Cottonwood was fair and that people aren't too unhappy with the prices. And like Faust at the Triangle, he cited increased transport costs of getting goods to his remote storefront. We are not a discount store, he said. We pay premium to get stuff down here.
Hello, this is Sonia reading the Fort Stockton Pioneer for Thursday, May 21st, 2020. CDC COVID-19 does not easily spread from surfaces and from animals to people. The Centers for Disease Control, CDC, updated its website information regarding the possible ways the COVID-19 virus is spread. The date of the change is not clear, but the CDC site now reads that COVID-19 is thought to spread mainly through close contact from person to person. Some people without symptoms may be able to spread the virus. We are still learning about how the virus spreads and the severity of illness it causes. The site also states that while it appears possible to contract COVID-19 from touching a surface, the date of the change is not clear, but the CDC site now reads that COVID-19 is thought to spread mainly through close contact from person to person. Some people without symptoms may be able to spread the virus. We are still learning about how the virus spreads and the severity of illness it causes. The site also states that while it appears possible to contract COVID-19 from touching a surface and then touching your mouth, nose, or eyes, it no longer is viewed as a main way to spread the virus. In addition, the chance of spread from animal to human is said to be low. Here is the text from the CDC webpage, How COVID-19 Spreads. COVID-19 is thought to spread mainly through close contact from person to person. Some people without symptoms may be able to spread the virus. We are still learning about how the virus spreads and the severity of illness it causes. Person-to-person spread. The virus is thought to spread mainly from person to person, between people who are in close contact with one another within about 6 feet, through respiratory droplets produced when an infected person coughs, sneezes, or talks. These droplets can land in the mouths or noses of people who are nearby or possibly be inhaled into the lungs. COVID-19 may be spread by people who are not showing symptoms. The virus spreads easily between people. How easily a virus spreads from person to person can vary. Some viruses are highly contagious, like measles, while other viruses do not spread as easily. Another factor is whether the spread is sustained, which means it goes from person to person without stopping. The virus that causes COVID-19 is spreading very easily and sustainably between people. Information from the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic suggests that this virus is spreading more efficiently than influenza, but not as efficiently as measles, which is highly contagious. City enters into deal with local hotel for possible voluntary housing of COVID-19 quarantine cases from TDCJ, First Responders. See the May 21st print and e-edition of the Pioneer for more information. The Fort Stockton City Council approved an agreement with the Quality Inn Motel to set aside 20 rooms for possible use by the city to house first responders or Texas Department of Criminal Justice employees who have been ordered into quarantine due to testing positive for the COVID-19 virus. The council, meeting in special session via a video conference on May 19, also decided to take no action on possible changes to Ordinance Number 20-107, which was Mayor Chris Alexander's declaration of local disaster issued March 24 in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. The motel plan comes with multiple layers of safety precautions, including hotel staff not servicing the room and barring a quarantined person from entering other parts of the hotel. If they, a TDCJ employee, wants to quarantine away from their family, this would be a spot, Alexander said, explaining that it was strictly a voluntary option. It was created after consultation with TDCJ leaders, according to the city manager, Frank Rodriguez. Fort Stockton kicks off local graduations Friday. Sanderson, Buena Vista, Ira Ann to follow. Here are the dates and times for local high school graduations. Please be sure to check with the school as attendance will be limited and restrictions may apply. Fort Stockton High School, 8 p.m. Friday, May 22nd on football field. Reserved seating only. Ceremony will be available live on the FSISD Facebook page. Sanderson High School, 5 p.m. Saturday, May 23rd on football field. Reserved seating only. Ceremony will be live streamed. Buena Vista High School, 8 p.m. Friday, June 5th on the football field, followed by a senior parade. Ceremony will adhere to all of the guidelines that have been laid out by TEA and CDC. Ira Ann High School, 7 p.m. Friday, June 26. Details to be announced. Kids can be cool and stay cool during summer workshop at the new Fort Stockton Community Theater. The Fort Stockton Community Theater is hosting a Be Cool in the New Nelson Street Theater and Stay Cool in Summer theater workshops during the month of June. Two 2-week workshops will be offered by Susan Hall and Alice Durskin for kids to learn theater skills and stage presence to prepare for a theater presentation at the end of June. Session 1 will be Monday through Friday, June 1 to 12. Session 2 will be Monday through Friday, June 15 to 26. Students who have completed kindergarten through the end of fourth grade will attend a section from 1 to 3 p.m. each afternoon, while students who have completed fifth grade through the end of seventh grade will attend from 3 to 5 p.m. each afternoon. Only 10 students per section will be allowed. Students will be screened with a non-touch thermometer, and hands will be washed upon entering and before leaving. The performances at the end of the workshops will allow for social distancing in the audience. The cost per student is $30 for the 2-week session. Students will learn to feel comfortable on stage before an audience and will learn to express themselves clearly in various characterizations. Students will use prepared scripts and storylines, as well as creating their own material to perform. Fort Stockton Community Theater is excited to offer the young people of our community an opportunity to be cool while they learn theater skills that will help them stay cool, enjoying the performing arts. We are very proud of the talented young people who have worked with us in productions through the years and are eager to encourage other young people to join the fun of live theater. For more information and to register for the workshop, call Susan Hall at 432-360-6618 or Alice Durskin at 432-336-3180.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahans News for Thursday, May 21st. Former MPD officer given 7 years on child porn charges. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. A former Monahans police officer was sentenced to 87 months, a little over 7 years, in federal prison on May 13th after pleading guilty on December 16th to child pornography charges. Marshall Lacey Hobbs, age 36, of Andrews, was sentenced by U.S. District Judge David Counts. In addition to the prison term, Judge David Counts ordered that Hobbs pay a $30,000 fine, a $5,000 assessment under the Amy and Vicky Child Pornography Victim Restitution Improvement Act, and a $5,000 assessment under the Justice for Victims of Trafficking Act. Judge Counts also ordered that Hobbs be placed on supervised release for a period of 5 years after completing his prison term. Hobbs, who had been on bond during this litigation, was remanded into the custody of the U.S. Marshals Service following the May 13th hearing in order to begin serving his prison term. Hobbs admitted to receiving pornographic images and videos from a 17-year-old Andrews High student with whom he was having a sexual relationship. On December 19, 2019, Hobbs pleaded guilty to one count, receipt of child pornography. Court records reveal that in November 2019, Hobbs knowingly engaged in social media communications on his cell phone with a female he knew to be under 18, and that he received multiple videos and images of that minor female engaged in sexually explicit activity. Quote, "When an officer who has sworn to protect his community instead decides to target a child for exploitation, we will be relentless in seeking justice. I am pleased with the sentence imposed today," stated U.S. Attorney Bash. The Texas Rangers investigated this case along with the Andrews Police Department. Assistant U.S. Attorney Shane Kreisman prosecuted this case on behalf of the government. This case was brought as part of Project Safe Childhood, a nationwide initiative to combat the epidemic of child sexual exploitation and abuse, launched in May 2006 by the Department of Justice. Led by U.S. Attorney's offices and the Criminal Division's Child Exploitation and Obscenity Section, Project Safe Childhood marshals federal, state, and local resources to better locate, apprehend, and prosecute individuals who exploit children via the Internet, as well as to identify and rescue victims. For more information about Project Safe Childhood, please visit www.projectsafechildhood.gov. In-person summer school allowed, although students don't have to go. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. On Monday, Governor Abbott gave the go-ahead for in-person summer school, Superintendent Chad Smith told the board during Monday's meeting. Quote, "We had our distance learning, remote instruction all set up, and then this decision came in today," he said. According to Abbott's executive order, schools can launch summer classes as early as June 1st, as long as they follow social distancing and health protocols laid out by the Department of State Health Services. Quote, "This would require daily temperature checks, keeping students' desks 6 feet apart, and limiting enclosed classrooms to 11, including the teacher," Smith said. The announcement Monday comes as part of Abbott's second phase of reopening the state after the coronavirus pandemic led to widespread government forced closures. Students will be invited to come to summer school to be promoted or make up days they've missed, but because of the COVID-19 pandemic, the district cannot make a student attend. Quote, "We did not anticipate a whole lot of students needing to attend summer school anyway, but it has to be offered for bilingual students and kids entering kindergarten," Smith said. Summer classes will be held at Sudirth Elementary and the high school. Further details will be released later regarding summer school and the summer meal program, he added. In other business, the preliminary estimates of taxable values for 2020 within the school district were reported by Smith as well. The preliminary estimate of more than $3.4 billion is up by over 13% over the 2019 final valuation of $3 billion. Quote, "The preliminary numbers in 2019 were 31% over 2018 numbers, but when the final numbers were released in July, it was 57% above 2018. Values are based upon the numbers from January 1st, so typically speaking, the numbers are very conservative, and the final numbers in July will most likely go up, said business manager Sarah Harris. Harris added, when I run the numbers based on the preliminary values, our budget should stay the same for the 2021 school year. Also, the school trustees congratulated the valedictorian and salutatorian for the 2018-2019 school year. Braden Carter is the valedictorian with a grade point average of 5.383. The salutatorian is Jordan Dominguez with a GPA of 5.24. Ward County, one of 32, with no corona cases. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. Every county that borders Ward County has or has had at least two cases of COVID-19. As of Monday afternoon, Ward County is one of only 32 counties in Texas that has no confirmed cases of the coronavirus. The latest report from Ward Memorial Hospital on Wednesday morning reflects 163 tested with 159 negative, no positives, and 4 pending. The results from the 27 tests given on May 9th were not received until Monday. All were negative, prompting County Judge Greg Holly to say, quote, in my mind, the mobile testing was basically pointless since it took 9 days to get the results. I don't know what possible benefit it would be today to find out that 9 days ago a resident was carrying the virus. At any rate, I'm glad they were all negative, end quote. As of Monday, Midland County had 120 reported cases with 12 deaths and 39 have recovered. Ector County has 115 cases with 4 deaths and 72 recoveries. Andrews County has reported 22 cases with 21 recovered and no deaths. Pecos County has 21 positive cases, 5 have recovered. Howard County has reported 6 cases with 1 death and 3 people have recovered. Crane County had 2 cases, both recovered. Reeves County has reported 7 cases and Winkler County 3. Statewide, there has been 48,693 positive cases with 1,347 deaths, a fatality rate of about 2.8%. Over 58%, 28,371 persons have recovered. Library to close temporarily. Online summer reading program begins June 4th. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. According to librarian Brenda Kiziar, the Ward County Library will close temporarily on May 25th through June 3rd, while the library relocates to the building behind the library, formerly known as the Ward County Convention Center, 400 East 4th Street. The library will be housed in the temporary building for approximately 10 months while the existing building is renovated. The renovation is expected to give a, quote, more open, new, and refreshing look, according to Bill Parsons, architect for the Vandergriff Group. Quote, every area of the library will get a facelift to add brighter colors and more open spaces. Additionally, access to the Ward County Archives, adjacent to the library, will be more direct from the library, he added. The project has been budgeted at $3 million and is expected to cost between $2 and $2.5 million. Beginning on June 4th, kids and parents can stop by the library in the new location to receive their reading log and packet for the online summer reading program. Quote, we will do an online story, Time and Craft, although we are not sure which platform we will use, Kiziar said. More details on the summer reading program will follow in a subsequent edition of the news. Anyone with questions can call the library at 432-943-3332. Here are some obituaries that appeared in the Monahans News on May 21st. Erica Deanne Sotelo Ontiveros passed on May 17th, surrounded by her family. Erica was born to Fernando G. and Yolanda S. Sotelo on March 27, 1979, in Odessa. Erica is preceded in death by her father, Fernando Garcia Sotelo, her nephews, Joshua Allen Ramsey, Jeremiah David Wilson, Joel Jesus Mata, niece, Angelica Sotelo, and her godson, Christian Harris. She is survived by her husband, Manuel A. Ontiveros Sr., children, Manuel A. Ontiveros Jr., Kayla M. Ontiveros, Crystal D. Ontiveros, Matthew E. F. Ontiveros, and adopted son, Dimitri Moreno. Her mother, Yolanda S. Sotelo, siblings, Connie Sotelo Jones, Riena Sotelo Hernandez, Danny Ray Sotelo, Tracy Sotelo Garza, Mickey Sotelo Chapman, and Joseph F. A. Sotelo. She is also survived by five grandchildren. Services were held Tuesday, May 19th at 2 p.m. at Cornerstone Pentecostal Church in Monahans. Burial followed at Monahans Memorial Cemetery in Monahans. Services were under the direction of Harkey Funeral Home. Send online condolences to our website, harkeyfunerals.com. Barbara Combs, age 80, of Wicket, passed away on May 13th at her home, surrounded by loved ones. She was born in Pitcher, Oklahoma, on February 1, 1940, to Carl and Orlena Simpson. Barbara was married to Benny Combs in Las Vegas, Nevada, on May 2, 1966. Barbara is preceded in death by her husband, Benny Combs, mother Orlena Basinger, sister Vonda Patrick, and brother Bill Simpson. She is survived by her son, Benny Combs of Wicket, son Travis of Wicket, three granddaughters, Yvonne Cervantes of Midland, Alyssa Combs, and Catelyn Combs, both of Wicket, one grandson, Ethan Joe Combs of Wicket, two great-granddaughters, one great-grandson. Graveside services were held at 10 a.m. Tuesday, May 19th, at Monahans Memorial Cemetery. Visit our website, harkeyfunerals.com, to sign the guest book or leave a personal message for the family. Funeral arrangements are under the direction of Harkey Funeral Home. Douglas Lee Brown passed away on May 3rd in Palestine, Texas. Doug, as he was affectionately known, was born on September 28, 1977, in Houston, to Neil Nash Brown, Jr., and the late Janet Faye Brown. He was living in Buffalo at the time of his death. Doug was preceded in death by his mother, Janet Faye Musselwhite, paternal grandparents, Neil Nash Brown Sr. and wife Darlene Lavoisse Lee, and maternal grandparents, George Wilson Lee and Faye Elizabeth Lennox. He is survived by his children, Madison Lene Brown, Rylan Kix Brown, Natalia Marie Brown, all of Monahans, his father, Neil Nash Brown, and wife Lisa of Buffalo, and his aunt, Karen Polasek, who was like a mother to Doug, and husband Clay of Liberty Hill, stepbrother Dakota Lewis, two nephews, and a niece, numerous other aunts and cousins. A graveside service will be held at a later date at the Buffalo Cemetery, officiated by Pastor Matt Travis of Buffalo, as well as a short tribute by Pastor Stan Hufty of Monahans. Burial will follow in the Buffalo Cemetery. Ramon Flores Martinez Sr. passed away at home on May 19, 2020. Funeral arrangements are pending at this time. Visit our website, harkeyfunerals.com, to sign the guest book or leave a personal note for the family. Funeral services are under the direction of Harkey Funeral Home. George Hemond passed away on May 18th. Funeral arrangements are pending at this time. Visit our website, harkeyfunerals.com, to sign the guest book or leave a personal note for the family. Funeral services are under the direction of Harkey Funeral Home.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texans. This is the Recording Library of West Texans, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.